Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 19th of January. In Congress, talk about capping troop levels, talk about a bipartisan non-binding resolution opposing the president's plan for an increased level of troops in Iraq. What can Congress do? What devices are available to Congress to demonstrate their preference in foreign and military policy? Our guest says legislation is one way. Congress can pass bills which affect the substance of policy, such as was done with the 1973 War Powers Resolution. On the other hand, Congress's control over the appropriation of funds, the so-called power of the purse, enables the legislative branch to continue or cut off funds being used for military operations, such as Iraq. What direction are they likely to go? What direction is most effective in Congress expressing a displeasure at the way that Iraq is going right now and also the American people's displeasure at the course of this war? We're going to talk about all of that the first hour of our program today with Professor Samuel Hoff, George Washington Distinguished Professor of History and Political Science and the Law Studies Director at Delaware State University. And we'll be welcoming Funk, and we should add he's a Packers fan. That's important in Wisconsin. We are going to welcome your phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Professor Samuel Hoff, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Ms. Dunn. Thank you very much for the invitation to join your program.
Our pleasure. This you've written about this. You talk about how Congress can employ a tactic they can employ to make their position known in foreign policy, the concurrent resolution. Is this the same thing as the non-binding resolution that everybody's talking about?
Yes, ma'am, it is. There are several types of bills and resolutions that Congress deals with on a regular basis. One is a simple resolution, which is passed by just one chamber, normally to change the operating rules on a temporary basis. Another one is the concurrent resolution, which is what we're talking about here. That must be passed by both chambers, but it's not something that goes to the president, and therefore it doesn't have the force of law, as opposed to a public bill, a private bill, or a joint resolution, all of which must be approved by both chambers and must go to the president for either his approval or an override of his veto.
I see. So is there a way to fashion a bill, because now we've got nine Republicans ready to vote with Democrats on this non-binding resolution opposing the president's plan, is there legally a way for both bodies to pass a binding resolution that the president could either veto or not veto, but it would have to go to his desk?
Not with the current concurrent resolution, but that brings up, you know, the reasons for the action that we have. And the resolution, as I understand it, is which was initiated by Delaware's Joe Biden and co-sponsored by a couple other senators, mentions that the United States cannot sustain an open-ended commitment in Iraq and recommends a political solution and recommends an accelerated training of Iraqi forces and also eventual repositioning of the U.S. troops to the Iraqi border. We have to ask look at the political situation as to why this is coming now and what the ultimate purpose of the concurrent resolution is.
What is it?
In my view, it's threefold. One is certainly to affect American public opinion, and we have to remember that legislators are elected by the people, and so that the assumption is that what the people want is what they're doing and vice versa. Mm-hmm. That's certainly an important function of the current resolution as it relates to Iraq. Another one, quite frankly, appears to be to, and as you alluded to before, to perhaps lead to something stronger and a binding resolution, in other words, a joint resolution, pursuant to this. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a test, particularly to see what Republicans in the Senate and House might join the Democrats. And certainly when you get influential Republicans such as Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, you're saying a lot about the nature of at least how some people feel on the resolution itself.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, I would certainly say that the purpose of the resolution is to give a message to the president of the position of Congress at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, hasn't he already been given that message or not?
Well, and that's a very good point. I mean, you know, we can say that the 2006 elections gave it to him in no uncertain terms, but I think what you're seeing is a frustration of members of Congress who for so long before that, at least the Democrats and certainly even some Republicans in the majority, thought that they were being ignored, and we heard so much about the so-called unilateral presidency, the being able to act without Congress, even when the Republicans controlled the both chambers for 4 out of the 6 years prior to the 2006 election.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're seeing now is just, you know, some might call it overkill, but regardless, we have to put it in the political context of when it's coming and what it's meant to do. Certainly, we also had President Bush's own admissions on 60 Minutes most recently last weekend, and Pentagon reassessments of the situation in Iraq, and the Iraq Study Group,
mm-hmm.
and intelligence estimates, all of these contributing, in my view, to what we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you, I know that, you know, there's no way to get a complete answer on this. We'd have to ask the president, and he's not very forthcoming. But why do you think, considering the election, considering the Iraq Study Group and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and commanders in the field, I mean, everybody's saying, we don't want this. Why do you think he's going this direction?
Well, in particular, there appears to be the possibility, and we always have to admit that securing Baghdad itself with an augmentation or surge or increase or whatever you want to call it of troops to the tune of approximately 20,000 could give momentum for securing other areas of Iraq and possibly doing it with either that level of troops and not have to increase it again, or even decreasing it from there. So there's a hope that if we can get a handle on Baghdad and immediate surrounding areas with the 20,000 additional troops, that it could lead to success in other areas. Meanwhile, ironically, I just watched a show yesterday that was talking about that in the Kurdish-controlled areas of Iraq, they actually have tour groups going over and visiting. Now, admittedly, it's dangerous. It's not something I would recommend to your listeners. But it's not that the entire country is destabilized, but certainly a large part is. And we will have to take a look very closely at the situation in Baghdad. And some say as Baghdad goes, the rest of the country is going to go. So the question of what happens if this strategy is not successful is certainly a good one.
What do you think the chances are of it being successful? What's your best guess on this?
I believe that the neighborhood by neighborhood sweeps that the military is doing is an effective tactic. And that's going to help a lot. There also has to be, as the resolution itself says, some stronger actions by the Iraqi prime minister. There needs to be stronger actions by other groups that can help. There needs to be a diminution of attacks by Sunnis and Shiites on each other and to stop, you know, the violence that we see here. And that's not going to happen unless people see that they have a stake in a country and that eventually the Americans will, as President Bush once put it, stand down once the country is stabilized. And some say that this gives the opposite impression, but others say it's necessary because of the security issues.
You've talked about American public opinion. Let's spend just a few moments on Iraqi public opinion. I'm not sure how these polls are taken, but recent polls do indicate that, you know, something like 90%, 98% of Iraqis are opposed to an American troop presence. Isn't it a pretty difficult situation here to have all these soldiers and then an increase in the number of soldiers to secure a country when they don't even want you there?
Well, that is a good question. On the other hand, the statistics are not optimistic from the number of Iraqis suffering because of the civil war itself. In fact, 35,000 were estimated to have been killed in 2006.
Yes.
I mean, that is a staggering figure. And you know, for every story that we see that somebody believes that the freedom fighters now become the occupiers, there's also a story that the Americans have protected neighborhoods against those other groups that are, that may just come in and try to wreak havoc there. So, you know, we could criticize the manner by which those polls were conducted, but it is true that there is divided opinion on the American presence there. But if we can assist while not dominating in the manner of building a democracy, and I think all of us as Americans are seeing how hard it is to build a democracy, something that we went through in our history more than two centuries ago. But that's what we're looking at in Iraq, and you know, looking at security, looking at the political institutions, looking at the nature of pluralism, looking at vital things like services. All of these things have to be done in order to secure the country, and hopefully they will be if the momentum can stay.
Mm-hmm. What about the other proposal that's being floated around this week, Senator Clinton, Senator Obama, asking to cap the level of troops in Iraq? What authority does Congress have in this area?
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned a number of areas of congressional tools, and indeed I've written about that before. Besides the non-binding resolutions like this, as you mentioned, the so-called power of the purse is probably the strongest of many powers that Congress has dealing with foreign policy in what seems like an area dominated by the president, constitutionally and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at issues of capping, it really would pertain to future-oriented budgets as opposed to the current budget. And as far as I understand, even those legislators haven't threatened to cut off existing funds to the troops that are already there. We're talking about future-oriented funds. But certainly in the whole budget process, and we, of course, are in the already in the process of 2008 fiscal year, which would start in October, and this will be a formative time between after the president gives his State of the Union and then gives his economic message with the 2008 budget. For discussion, debate, and possible action to cap things by those who favor that. And then, of course, it would go through the process of having go back and forth between the president and Congress. And if the president doesn't like that, he could take actions, many actions that he has in the foreign policy arena to try to counter that.
Does Congress have, within its ability, the power to say we're not going to fund an additional 22,000 troops?
Yes, in the sense of looking at something that would entail funding within the current year. But again, my understanding is that the funding for a certain amount of our defense budget has already going through this year. So the question then is, well, can they stop something that occurs this year? And looking at it's a kind of chess game between the president and Congress. And one thing is possible. It's not something that's regularly done, but a lawsuit by members of Congress, it's not unprecedented. It was done, for instance, by Senator Barry Goldwater and others when they were upset at the elimination of a defense treaty with Taiwan back in the 70s when the Carter administration wanted to normalize relations with China. So that's something that can be done. Certainly constant oversight by Congress in reference to that. Even though the Supreme Court ostensibly ruled it unconstitutional back in 1983, there is still an informal tool called a legislative veto, which Congress can try to stave off funding like that. But on the other hand, there are so many tools that the president possesses to keep things going, whether it be using national emergency legislation or contingency funds or the like to do that. Right now, I understand that the debate is going to be future oriented, and the nature of things right now is what we're looking at.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. Professor Samuel Hoff is our guest, George Washington Distinguished Professor of History and Political Science, also the Law Studies Director at Delaware State University. We're talking about the power, the authority that Congress has over foreign and military policy, particularly as it relates to Iraq, and welcoming your phone calls. Our lines are busy right now, but keep trying and you'll get through. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Mary from Madison is our first caller for you, Professor. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I would like your guest to comment on what we meant to do and what we have achieved there and where things are. And I'd like to give my synopsis of that first and have him comment.
Mm-hmm.
We've killed the dictator. We got revenge on him, and he was a nasty man, but it was basically for revenge. We've made the oil companies rich, and there is no functioning democracy. There were no weapons of mass destruction, so I'm not sure what we have achieved. And I think there's an ego trip here in that the men running our country don't want to lose face that, gee, we lied, and we made a whole lot of mistakes, and 3,000 people are Americans are dead.
Professor Hoff.
Well, your listener certainly has her opinion on the points. We start with elements of fact that she mentioned. Certainly the issue of weapons of mass destruction was the primary reason at the beginning for the Bush administration's policy and going it alone, despite the United Nations Security Council resolution to invade Iraq in 2003. The evidence ostensibly before that came from some Iraqi officials who had requested asylum and then given information on Saddam's developing WMDs. It had peripherally come from estimates, albeit not actual findings, of UN inspectors in Iraq and from intelligence estimates. And the fact that largely they were not found, although certainly chemical weapons were used by Saddam in the war with Iran, in the 1980s, and then against his own population, the Kurds, after the war, gave the United States the impression that there would be a much larger cache of weapons, as well as the ultimate WMD nuclear weapon. The fact that those weren't found resulted certainly in a change of direction for the American policy in the area, and was, you know, part of the whole idea of preemptive strikes. And I, the thing I share with your listener is the fact that preemptive strikes or a policy of preemption has to be so sure that something is, that is vital to protecting Americans. In other words, so possibly damaging to American national security exists before it is used, and if that's not the case, as it was here, it really puts a needle in the balloon of preemption, and perhaps is going to lead to a serious diminution, if not an elimination, of that kind of strategy. I'm not only talking about the Bush administration, I'm talking about the future. Now, in some cases, that's certainly good, because you wouldn't get into a situation, as your listener said, of over 3,000 American killed, not to mention the number of Iraqis in the 4 years since the war started. But it could be a negative in the sense where those WMDs actually exist, and because of the development of the situation in Iraq, we would be adverse to going in, and that could be a problem for American policy in the future. But on that issue in particular, the what was thought and the consequences have been devastating for American foreign policy, and I certainly agree with the listener on that issue.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary, very much for your call. Scott is next from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. There's so many facets to this war in Iraq, and I just wanted to cover a couple of them. First of all, it'd be nice if we got out. But that being said, the one thing that I don't hear talk about, and I know George Bush is a hated man by the left. I mean, it's quite evident. I think we've got a president that sincerely thinks, and people miss this point, sincerely thinks he's doing the right thing. And I take a gentleman like John McCain, who's quite a pragmatist in most issues. I mean, he really is the Democrats' favorite Republican, especially when he's railing against Republicans. But this is a pragmatist in John McCain who is adamant about the fact that it is going to be devastating if we just pull out. And I think those are the two competing views. I don't see a solution from the Democrats at all. I mean, this non-binding resolution, you said there were three reasons for it. I think there is a fourth. I think there's a political motive by actually trying to undermine and embarrass the president to some aspect. But I don't see a solution from Democrats at all. And I really, truly believe McCain when he says that it would be devastating for us if we just pulled out of there.
Professor Hoff.
Well, the last point that your listener mentioned, we can't deny that a number of the people who are active in sponsoring the resolution are presidential candidates, if not officially, at least leaning toward that way. And it seems like there is a plethora of senators. Of course, we'd be looking at the first sitting senator that would become president since JFK if one of those several makes it. So if not an outright motive, certainly as a consequence, we can attribute kind of political motives to a number of people. I know they would probably deny that, but it's hard to do it when they're running simultaneous for that. I share your listeners' anxiety about the nature of what appears to be these two different directions, that kind of a push and pull. And, you know, I happen to have been in Vietnam in the summer of 2004 and actually visited the what's left of the Hanoi Hilton, and they actually had a picture of John McCain, the flyer, as well as a number of others who were prisoners there. And as your listener was talking, it made me think about, you know, what he experienced as a POW during the Vietnam War and the nature of how he believes wars should be fought. And so his idea is to not shortchange the troops that are there. And if, in fact, we agree that we are in a war, then we should fight to win and not fight to maintain something or to prevent from losing. You know, the sort of shock and awe strategy. I think Senator McCain is frustrated that we have deviated from the Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force, and that and instead of looking at recriminations of what happened in the post-2003 invasion, that we should try to solve the problem now. And in that sense, I think your listener has a good point. On the other hand, is the new Democratic majority, and on the one hand, we could say, well, as President Bush has pushed them to come up with solutions, but I think that there are solutions being bannered around in these various ideas and in the resolution. People may not agree to it, but trying to accelerate the training of Iraqi forces by having not only more American soldiers, but perhaps other countries. The Egyptians, I know, have been literally pleading with the Americans to assist in the training, and we haven't really taken advantage of that as much, and as well as other countries. And a kind of strategy where we would have more presence at the border, preventing groups from infiltrating into the country. And of course, recently the finger has pointed toward Iran in terms of fomenting trouble within Iraq itself. And of course, the arrest of some Iranians charged with doing just that. So I think these are proposals. They may not be things that people agree with, but at least they are alternatives that are coming from Democrats and even from some Republicans who share the goals of the concurrent resolution introduced a couple days ago.
Don't you think, though, when we talk about McCain and the listener does, that his star is falling here, it seems to me. The polls in the early primary states are showing his numbers going down the tubes, whereas Senator Hagel's star is ascending. That the American public, I think, or the people who are speaking here, and even the Democrats, are kind of Johnny's come lately to what the American public response is that they want those troops, they want our troops out of there. So the Democrats are trying to fashion some kind of thing here, and the American public is, and Democrats are saying one thing, and a lot of Republicans are saying the same thing. So the message is coming through that the president is, and John McCain, for that matter, are increasingly isolated on this.
Well, and it's a some testament to Senator McCain that he is has said that he would rather have the war won than win an election.
Yeah.
In the ostensible likelihood that he would be a candidate for president in 2008, and that that's a courageous position given the situation right now. He certainly is not allied with too many other people in terms of the increase, which he argued really before the president came up with this with his policy and announced it last week. So you could argue, at least in the surge policy, John McCain's out front there. But certainly, as one of the NBC commentators mentioned, that saying that President Bush bet his presidency on the Iraq and then just doubled the bet with his strategy on changing the policy last week. That in some ways John McCain is part of that, and given the American public's views would possibly benefit or possibly fall as a result of that. Even though we, of course, have to recognize that being president is a burden that has a number of other priorities as well, although we're certainly fixated on the Iraqi situation right now.
Scott, thanks very much for the call. We go to Robert from Madison next. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. First of all, I want to comment about the Democratic plan. I believe that the Democrats do have a plan, and I believe that nobody's enunciating it correctly because it's implied in what they're trying to say. They're saying get the troops out of Iraq. That's definitely true. They're saying give some more equipment to the Iraqis to take care of their situation. They're definitely saying give some more training up to a limited point. Then what they're also saying is, listen, a lot of things can happen. One is that the people in Iraq will come to the conclusion, we don't have the United States to blame anymore. Let's stop the fighting. Let's figure out how to solve our own problems politically. The second thing that could happen is that they're going to indeed go into a more intense civil war, in which case some not-so-innocent people are going to get killed, and some innocent people will get killed too. But guess what? Innocent people get killed because of man-made reasons and or natural reasons. The third thing that can happen is that this can escalate to Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Turkey. I'll tell you something. If those countries all get into it in big time, they're going to come up with a political solution because they don't want to upset their own apple carts. And by the way, when Iran was fighting Iraq and a million people were getting killed on both sides, it wasn't a big problem for the United States to watch that on the sides and counterfeit weapons and money to whatever victor was not going to be the right winner in this particular process. So the answer is the Democratic plan is we will get out of there, and secondly, what evolves. We will certainly try to facilitate a political process, but if these people want to fight and want to kill each other, let them go at it. That's fine. Whoever wins, if the wrong winner wins, by the way, I guess we could do something about that at that particular point, either with the help of the Saudis or with the help of Israel. Comment on those items.
Thanks, Robert. Professor Hoff.
Well, not as many Democrats as we might think are taking your listener's position, but apparently a few are, and it seems that Senator Obama and a few other have come out in the plain, blunt terms that your listener gave in terms of what should be done. I would say that as we look back at American foreign policy, I'm struck by your listener's comments about the American position during the Iran-Iraq war. I think he hit the nail on the head. I mean, we look at American foreign policy like any country's foreign policy, and it's a combination of their history and their own government setup and the country's values. And, you know, we fight. I think it's important to understand not only the Gulf War in the early 90s, but the Second War or the subsequent invasion, the 2000 invasion against Iraq. And the only way you can do that is really look at the background of American foreign policy and the way that your listener alluded to it. I would note the circumstances of the, you know, what was going on in that war in the 80s and how it had an impact later on, and also the American policy. I mean, you know, we had come out of the hostage crisis with Iran. On the other hand, the Iran-Contra scandal was the result of trying to make some backdoor linkages to Iran and try to get their help in freeing some of our hostages in the Middle East. On the other hand, there we were feeding intelligence estimates to Iraq, and as the story goes, there were some direct linkages between personnel in the State Department and Saddam in the early 90s that, from Saddam's standpoint, gave him the green light to invade Kuwait in the first Gulf War. So, from a real cynic's view, we're cleaning up the mess that we created, albeit we can't really look at it as in a vacuum. I mean, a number of other countries are involved. And that's the point, I think, about the current area and about some of the Democrats' views on the issue, is that they would like to see more of the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group implemented, and the resolution, as I understand it, actually mentions many of those resolutions. And one of them, of course, is trying to get the help of other countries in the region. And so some say that, well, given our past policy, such as I mentioned before, that it doesn't make sense to now essentially reject any negotiation or discussion with Iran or with Syria, who are two of the countries that we're blaming for a lot of the attacks and a lot of the weapons being funneled into the rebel groups and insurgent groups within Iraq itself. And so how we proceed and it is certainly related to those recommendations, but also related to what we've done in the past and the nature of trying to resolve a conflict. And some see the need to keep all channels open, despite what seems to be repugnant, particularly given the Iran president's recent conference that he had, essentially denying the Holocaust.
Thanks very much for the call, Robert. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Samuel Hoff. He's George Washington Distinguished Professor of History and Political Science and the Law Studies Director at Delaware State University. We're looking at the congressional response to the president and what tools Congress has to impact decisions and actions in the international arena. One line is open at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee, 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second of our program on this Friday, we'll be speaking with two professors from the University of River Falls who teach courses in the psychology of racism and the representation of the news. Our guests are Associate Professor of Psychology and a Professor of Journalism. We'll be looking at the psychology of prejudice and racism and the representation of class and race in the news media. So that'll be an interesting conversation. Back to phone calls now for Professor Samuel Hoff. We go to Ken from Albany. Hello, Ken.
Hello. I wonder if we can talk about the unthinkable, whereby the 140,000 troops on the ground are captured. And this really is not unthinkable because there's enough of the enemy around to do that. And I don't think we have anybody like MacArthur, who was from Milwaukee, who will be saying, you know, we shall return.
All right. Capturing of American troops. Professor Hoff.
Well, the that's one thing that luckily we've had a minimum of exposure to, as opposed to, it seems like given the number of troops and the length of time that we've had less incidents than we had in the first Gulf War when there were a couple well-publicized POWs. That always exists. So in that sense, if not the unthinkable, as your listener defined it, that every American soldier would be captured, even a good number, is something that we have to consider. That's one of the downsides of any war. And you only hope that, you know, the Iraqis don't treat us like we were alleged to have treated them. And from investigations of Abu Ghraib and certainly even from in the Western Hemisphere in Guantanamo Bay, that those kind of actions against detainees certainly can boomerang. And, you know, you hope that people treat people according to the Geneva Accords and to international humanitarian standards. But the issue of POWs is a good one, and we've minimized that so far, and hopefully that would occur after that. The other thing that your listener mentioned about General MacArthur is also a good lesson, and that of course came from the Korean War in the sense of the changing strategy. And I'm not sure your listener meant it that way, but that's not a bad analogy. We started the Korean War wanting to simply go make sure that North Koreans were kicked back to the border with South Korea, and then the strategy changed whereby we decided that we may have had the momentum to actually win the war against North Korea and make the entire Korean Peninsula democratic. And, of course, the intervention of the Chinese changed that significantly, and the disagreements that MacArthur had with President Truman as a result resulted in him being fired. But that is a good example of how strategies can change during a war, and certainly we've seen it in just as a blunt fashion in the Iraq.
Thanks very much for the call. Can we talk about time here for a moment, Professor Hoff? We've been there for 4 years now. If you look at certain indications, things are not very good. They're not much better here. We've got an incredible number of people dying. You can't go to a university. You might get blown up. The professional class has left. You got refugees all over the place. I'm wondering, so you put in 22,000 more troops. You've got a government that indications are depends on its survival in some measure by the existence of some of these insurgent groups. You don't have a lot of political dialogue going on, so you can work out the differences between the Sunnis and the Shias. It just seems to me as though this could go on and on and on and on, and we see very little progress when it comes to the different sides making accommodations for each other.
Well, and that's an interesting point. The one thing you mentioned about refugees is bugging a lot of people now, and that was a recent determination by the American government not to admit a large number of Iraqi refugees who essentially were allied to American military or American policy and fear for their life, and that has upset a lot of people. But that's certainly another thing we could talk about, not only the refugees themselves, but the treatment of them by the American government. Again, you've characterized the essence of the situation. You know, war is ugly, and the types of victories, the types of things that would lead us to think that things are improving sometimes are hard to come by. Certainly the media has done a good job. They've done largely a fair job in covering the war and various aspects of it. And sometimes they're not in a situation, whether because they're embedded with troops or for other reasons, to see some of the good things or some of the slow building of a democracy, which isn't quite honestly a juicy story for in many cases. But those things are happening as well, and you can only hope that, as I mentioned, going the block to block and securing areas and trying to get the troops involved will somehow come to a positive enough conclusion that we see that we've done, you know, we've tried to do the job that we've had.
Would you put a time limit on it?
Well, when we think about a time limit, as in you mentioned at the beginning of our broadcast, the War Powers Resolution, which, and I was lucky enough to serve the senator who authored that, Senator Jacob Javits. And, you know, we go back to the reason for the part of what was put into the War Powers Resolution, which was a 60 to 90 day period for troops to be involved in hostilities, although the time could be renewed. And the idea is to make sure that the President and Congress are on the same wavelength when we commit our troops to a foreign conflict, and as well as to make sure that the American people are supporting it. And that's really the bottom line behind any discussion of a time limit, is that it is consistent with what the American people want in terms of a war or a conflict. And when we look at it, certainly there should be incentives for timelines for improvements and then consequences if those improvements aren't made. And that includes the training, you know, targets for training of enough Iraqi troops to take over a lot of the operation, as they've done, and that's one area that seems to be improving over time, as well as for a reduction of attacks by insurgents. And that, you know, that's going to take the willpower of not only the American troops and the American people, but certainly the Iraqis themselves, in trying to stave off those sort of things.
Let's go to Mike from Fox Point. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I guess I would like to make a comment. I'm a career teacher. I'm retired now, but a career teacher in the state of Wisconsin. This administration put in No Child Left Behind, which basically said if you have a failed school system, you're going to cut off funds. My view would be this has been a failed administration on the Iraqi war, and I think our point of discussion today is, what should Congress do? I think funds should be cut off. There has been nothing that has been, we were promised things that would happen, they haven't happened. We have been lied to, I think, as to the causes of the war, and I think it's time to cut funds and get out.
Okay, Mike, I don't want to cut you short, but you sound like you're on an ocean somewhere transmitting on a radio, but we got the gist here. Professor Hoff, what do you think?
I first want to comment on your listener's occupation, and certainly we commend him for his commitment to education. When you look at the spending in the Iraqi war, there was an article in Wednesday's New York Times that compared the annual $200 billion that is estimated to be spent to various other priorities in American life. And one of them was education, where the estimate is that we're spending $35 billion. So, upwards of nine times the amount on this war as education. And that certainly rankles a lot of people. But it also shows the nature of a commitment like this. I did want to add to what I mentioned before about ways that Congress can fight the president in terms of foreign policy. And again, you hope that it leads to some consensus and some level of conciliation and cooperation. But, of course, congressional oversight over existing policies in terms of hearings or asking for documents, asking for people to testify, is an ongoing function of Congress, and that can be increased in terms of foreign relations committees and intelligence panels to make sure that Congress is aware of what's going on. Again, one of the real frustrations of the Congress, and ironically, even when it was controlled by the Republicans, is that the administration so many times on the in the Iraqi conflict has seemed to go it alone and not provided enough information for Congress to make a determination. So that ratcheting up the oversight hearings is one of the ways. Visits by lawmakers. I mean, Hillary Clinton just came back from the region. Joe Biden had been over there a number of times and made his point known as a prelude to the current resolution that we're talking about. You know, that in fact give those members of Congress a firsthand view of what's going on. And one of them, of course, actually had announced that when he was over there, change of position, Senator Brownback, I believe, and that that was a significant action by what had been on the Iraq situation, a loyal ally to the White House. Floor speeches, and we've seen more of those in Congress, asking for government accountability office studies, and we've seen those, and they've been used for the Iraqi study group and other aspects. Having caucuses in Congress issue policy statements, or having the leaders, party leaders in the House and Senate issue policy statements. All those things can be done, and I think all those together could lead to what your listener favors in terms of this policy.
Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. We go next to Ron from Osseo. Hi, Ron. Oh, I got to press the button. Hi, Ron. And, sorry. Go ahead. You'll have to repeat your first couple words.
Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
And I guess I agree with them, all your callers up till now, pretty much what they've been talking about. But what I'm wondering is what the specific assignments of these additional troops is going to be. Going door to door and asking somebody if they are an insurgent, oh, that seems just so foolish. But the one thing I did pick up this week, I don't know if this is one of their actual goals, they're going to embed our troops in the local police station. And I'm just surprised that nobody has recognized the inherent danger. Up till now, we go back to safe zones. Can you imagine 50 to 200 people in a police station with no perimeter backup? That's just asking for massive...
Much more dangerous. Yeah, would you agree with that? Much more dangerous, Professor Hoff?
Well, we've seen a lot of attacks against recruits for both police and military, and hopefully our troops are cognizant of that and the need, as your listener mentions, to establish those kind of perimeters more and more for those types of positions. The embedding is part of the role of the extra 20,000 troops and is seen as two things. It's seen as making sure that the Iraqis take the lead, but also making sure that there aren't the type of incidents that we saw before where the troops themselves are either deserting or guilty of the types of infractions against the citizenry that we certainly want to avoid. And then, of course, there is other areas within the Baghdad region that is part of the goal of those extra troops. And as I said, we're seeing some progress in terms of looking at that. And at the same time, I think that it's imperative that we try to have other countries who are willing to assist us in the training of those troops help us out. Because if the Americans do want to go back to 140,000 amount or even less than 100,000, as some have said, by 2008, that's one way that I think it can be done while still having the potential to secure the country.
And thanks, Ron, very much for your call. We thank you, Professor Hoff, for being with us. We've been on here, I think, about all the conversations we've had on this topic, and My gosh, we've had a lot of them over the past 5 years, actually. So we appreciate your contribution to our wealth of knowledge, although I don't think we know what to do. We don't know what the best thing is to do here at this point. So.
Well, and that's, you know, it does speak to America as a democracy itself. You know, we argue, we are divided sometimes, but ultimately we come to some sort of a agreement as a country that includes the government and the people, and hopefully that'll occur in this policy, and then it will be implemented accordingly. Thanks so much for having me on your program.
Yes, thank you. Professor Samuel Hoff, George Washington Distinguished Professor of History and Political Science, also the Law Studies Director at Delaware State University, joining us to talk primarily about the role of Congress, the authority Congress has in foreign and military policy. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production, answering all the calls here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all the calls, everybody, to our studio here in Milwaukee. Copies of the show, call the radio store, 800-747-7444. The program number of this hour is 119D, 119D. News is ahead from National Public Radio, and we'll be back with a real interesting next hour, so stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.